process of reasoning that conscious thought would have applied, the archetypal mind has stepped in and taken over the task of prognostication. The archetypes thus have their own initiative and their own specific energy. These powers enable them both to produce a meaningful interpretation in their own symbolic style and to interfere in a given situation with their own impulses and their own thought formations. In this respect, they function like complexes. They come and go very much as they please, and often they obstruct or modify our conscious intentions in an embarrassing way. We can perceive the specific energy of archetypes when we experience the peculiar fascination that accompanies them. They seem to hold a special spell. Such a peculiar quality is also characteristic of the personal complexes, and just as personal complexes have their individual history, so do social complexes of an archetypal character. But while personal complexes never produce more than a personal bias, archetypes create myths, religions, and philosophies that influence and characterize whole nations and epochs of history. We regard the personal complexes as compensations for one-sided or faulty attitudes of consciousness. In the same way, myths of a religious nature can be interpreted as a sort of mental therapy for the sufferings and anxieties of mankind in general: hunger, war, disease, old age, death. The universal hero myth, for example, always refers to a powerful man or god-man who vanquishes evil in the form of dragons, serpents, monsters, demons, and so on, and who liberates his people from destruction and death. The narration or ritual repetition of sacred texts and ceremonies, and the worship of such a figure with dances, music, hymns, prayers, and sacrifices, grip the audience with numinous emotions, as if with magic spells, and exalt the individual to an identification with the hero. If we try to see such a situation with the eyes of a believer, we can perhaps understand how the ordinary man can be liberated from his personal impotence and misery, and endowed, at least temporarily, with an almost superhuman quality. Often enough, such a conviction will sustain him for a long time and give a certain style to his life. It may even set the tone of a whole society. A remarkable instance of this can be found in the Eleusinian mysteries, which were finally suppressed at the beginning of the 7th century of the Christian era. They expressed, together with the Delphic oracle, the essence and spirit of ancient Greece. On a much greater scale, the Christian era itself owes its name and significance to the antique mystery of the God-man, which has its roots in the archetypal Osiris-Horus myth of ancient Egypt. It is commonly assumed that on some given occasion in prehistoric times, the basic mythological ideas were invented by a clever old philosopher or prophet, and ever afterward believed by a credulous and uncritical people. It is said that stories told by a power-seeking priesthood are not true, but merely wishful thinking. But the very word invent is derived from the Latin invenire, and means to find, and hence to find something by seeking it. In the latter case, the word itself hints at some foreknowledge of what you are going to find. Let me go back to the strange ideas contained in the dreams of the little girl. It seems unlikely that she sought them out, since she was surprised to find them. They occurred to her rather as peculiar and unexpected stories, which seemed noteworthy enough to be given to her father as a Christmas present. In doing so, however, she lifted them up into the sphere of our still living Christian mystery, the birth of our Lord, mixed with the secret of the evergreen tree that carries the newborn light. This is the reference of the fifth dream. Although there is ample historical evidence for the symbolic relation between Christ and the tree symbol, the little girl's parents would have been gravely embarrassed had they been asked to explain exactly what they meant by decorating a tree with burning candles to celebrate the nativity of Christ. "Oh, it's just a Christmas custom," they would have said. A serious answer would require a far-reaching dissertation about the antique symbolism of the dying god and its relation to the cult of the Great Mother and her symbol, the tree, to mention only one aspect of this complicated problem. The further we delve into the origins of a collective image, or, to express it in ecclesiastical language, of a dogma, the more we uncover a seemingly unending web of archetypal patterns that before modern times were never the object of conscious reflection. Thus, paradoxically enough, we know more about mythological symbolism than did any generation before our own. The fact is that in former times men did not reflect upon their symbols. They lived them and were unconsciously animated by their meaning. I will illustrate this by an experience I once had with the primitives of Mount Elgon in Africa. Every morning at dawn, they leave their huts and breathe or spit into their hands, which they then stretch out to the first rays of the sun, as if they were offering either their breath or their spittle to the rising god, to Mungu. This Swahili word, which they used in explaining the ritual act, is derived from a Polynesian root, equivalent to mana or mulungu. These and similar terms designate a power of extraordinary efficiency and pervasiveness, which we should call divine. Thus the word Mungu is their equivalent for Allah or God. When I asked them what they meant by this act, or why they did it, they were completely baffled. They could only say, "We have always done it. It has always been done when the sun rises." They laughed at the obvious conclusion that the sun is Mungu. The sun indeed is not Mungu when it is above the horizon. Mungu is the actual moment of the sunrise. What they were doing was obvious to me, but not to them. They just did it, never reflecting on what they did. They were consequently unable to explain themselves. I concluded that they were offering their souls to Mungu because the breath of life and the spittle meant soul substance. To breathe or spit upon something conveys a magical effect, as for instance when Christ used spittle to cure the blind, or where a son inhales his dying father's last breath in order to take over the father's soul. It is most unlikely that these Africans ever, even in the remote past, knew any more about the meaning of their ceremony. In fact, their ancestors probably knew even less, because they were even more profoundly unconscious of their motives and thought less about their doings. Goethe's Faust aptly says, "Im Anfang war die Tat," in the beginning was the deed. Deeds were never invented, they were done. Thoughts, on the other hand, are a relatively late discovery of man. First, he was moved to deeds by unconscious factors. It was only a long time afterward that he began to reflect upon the causes that had moved him, and it took him a very long time indeed to arrive at the preposterous idea that he must have moved himself, his mind being unable to identify any other motivating force than his own. We should laugh at the idea of a plant or an animal inventing itself. Yet there are many people who believe that the psyche or mind invented itself, and thus was the creator of its own existence. As a matter of fact, the mind has grown to its present state of consciousness as an acorn grows into an oak, or as saurians developed into mammals. As it has for so long been developing, so it still develops, and thus we are moved by forces from within as well as by stimuli from without. These inner motives spring from a deep source that is not made by consciousness and is not under its control. In the mythology of earlier times, these forces were called mana, or spirits, demons, and gods. They are as active today as they ever were. If they conform to our wishes, we call them happy hunches or impulses and pat ourselves on the back for being smart fellows. If they go against us, then we say that it is just bad luck, or that certain people are against us, or that the cause of our misfortunes must be pathological. The one thing we refuse to admit is that we are dependent upon powers that are beyond our control. It is true, however, that in recent times civilized man has acquired a certain amount of willpower, which he can apply where he pleases. He has learned to do his work efficiently without having recourse to chanting and drumming to hypnotize him into a state of doing. He can even dispense with a daily prayer for divine aid. He can carry out what he proposes to do, and he can apparently translate his ideas into action without a hitch, whereas the primitive seems to be hampered at each step by fears, superstitions, and other unseen obstacles to action. The motto, "Where there's a will, there's a way," is the superstition of modern man. Yet in order to sustain his creed, contemporary man pays the price in a remarkable lack of introspection. He is blind to the fact that with all his rationality and efficiency, he is possessed by powers that are beyond his control. His gods and demons have not disappeared at all. They have merely got new names. They keep him on the run with restlessness, vague apprehensions, psychological complications, an insatiable need for pills, alcohol, tobacco, food, and, above all, a large array of neuroses. The soul of man. What we call civilized consciousness has steadily separated itself from the basic instincts. But these instincts have not disappeared. They have merely lost their contact with our consciousness and are thus forced to assert themselves in an indirect fashion. This may be by means of physical symptoms, as in the case of a neurosis, or by means of incidents of various kinds, such as unaccountable moods, unexpected forgetfulness, or mistakes in speech. A man likes to believe that he is the master of his soul, but as long as he is unable to control his moods and emotions, or to be conscious of the myriad secret ways in which unconscious factors insinuate themselves into his arrangements and decisions, he is certainly not his own master. These unconscious factors owe their existence to the autonomy of the archetypes. Modern man protects himself against seeing his own split state by a system of compartments. Certain areas of outer life and of his own behavior are kept, as it were, in separate drawers and are never confronted with one another. As an example of this so-called compartment psychology, I remember the case of an alcoholic who had come under the laudable influence of a certain religious movement and, fascinated by its enthusiasm, had forgotten that he needed a drink. He was obviously and miraculously cured by Jesus, and he was correspondingly displayed as a witness to divine grace or to the efficiency of the said religious organization. But after a few weeks of public confessions, the novelty began to pale, and some alcoholic refreshment seemed to be indicated, and so he drank again. But this time the helpful organization came to the conclusion that the case was pathological and obviously not suitable for an intervention by Jesus, so they put him into a clinic to let the doctor do better than the divine healer. This is an aspect of the modern cultural mind that is worth looking into. It shows an alarming degree of dissociation and psychological confusion. If, for a moment, we regard mankind as one individual, we see that the human race is like a person carried away by unconscious powers, and the human race also likes to keep certain problems tucked away in separate drawers. But this is why we should give a great deal of consideration to what we are doing, for mankind is now threatened by self-created and deadly dangers that are growing beyond our control. Our world is, so to speak, dissociated like a neurotic, with the Iron Curtain marking the symbolic line of division. Western man, becoming aware of the aggressive will to power of the East, sees himself forced to take extraordinary measures of defense at the same time as he prides himself on his virtue and good intentions. What he fails to see is that it is his own vices, which he has covered up by good international manners, that are thrown back in his face by the communist world, shamelessly and methodically. What the West has tolerated, but secretly and with a sense of shame, the diplomatic lie, systematic deception, veiled threats, comes back into the open and in full measure from the East and ties us up in neurotic knots. It is the face of his own evil shadow that grins at Western man from the other side of the Iron Curtain. It is this state of affairs that explains the peculiar feeling of helplessness of so many people in Western societies. They have begun to realize that the difficulties confronting us are moral problems, and that the attempts to answer them by a policy of piling up nuclear arms or by economic competition is achieving little, for it cuts both ways. Many of us now understand that moral and mental means would be more efficient, since they could provide us with psychic immunity against the ever-increasing infection. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.